Welcome to .NET Rambles, a weekly podcast where Andy and Rowan discuss all things .NET related.
Hello, Andy.
Hi, Rowan. How are you doing?
Very well, thanks. Very well. We're talking at the beginning of the week this episode, aren't we?
Because we are. Yeah.
Last week was school holidays, and we had a bit of a different week last week. You were away for the end of the week.
It was. Yeah, that was the main problem, wasn't it? Yeah, I was away. I decided to take the day off on a bit of a last minute thing because it was school holidays. Obviously, the kids were off. We were getting bored, so took the day off. Decided to go up to London, spend the day in London. See the sights. Didn't see the sights we wanted to see because it was school holiday and everything was busy. So, surprise, surprise, everything was really busy.
Not surprised. Well, yeah.
Yeah, that was it. So, I didn't get to see the Queen either. So,
that's a shame.
She's behind closed doors, isn't she? Because she's not too well at the moment. So
she's not too well. Although, I did see in the news that she's driving around the estate against medical advice.
Yeah, and I think she did a video call to the COP26.
She did, people, yeah. She was planning on being there,
I think, but
she's done a video call instead. So yeah. Good on her. She's incredible.
She gave him a telling off over video, which was good.
Yeah, brilliant. Like that. Absolutely. Were you there? Were you in London in the evening? Did you stay after dark?
No, we managed to escape about half five. We managed to get back to Victoria, jump on a train. So we got out just before that, yeah. So it was dark because it's starting to get dark quite early now, isn't it? So
it did
start getting darker and the lights started coming on. But we were quite lucky actually. Jumped on the train, it was quite clear. So had a nice train journey back.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So we're looking at things this week, aren't we? We're going to chat about... I won't spoil it until we get to the main thing, but you've got a random fact for us, haven't you? I'd say you told me about it earlier, but it went straight over my head, so you're going to have to tell me this many, many times before it evens.
Well,
it's just mad.
Being in London after dark, I was going to check to see if you happened to look skyward and whether you saw any neutron star floating around up there.
I can't say I did, and I'd also say I wouldn't know one if I saw it, to be honest.
Brilliant.
It parked next to me.
Well, if you did, it would probably fall to Earth in a blaze of glory, because apparently a teaspoon of neutron star would weigh about 6 billion tons, which is mind-blowing.
That's with a B, billions.
Billions, 6 billion tons. Yeah, just one teaspoon of neutron star.
Wow.
And what is a neutron star, I hear you ask? Well,
absolutely.
Yeah, well, a neutron star is the remnants of a massive star that's run out of fuel, and that dying star explodes in a supernova, and as part of that explosion, it collapses, the star itself collapses in on itself due to the force of the gravity, and it forms an incredibly super dense material known as neutron star, made out of, neutrons. And it is one of the most densely packed forms of matter known in the universe, which is incredible.
Wow.
Apparently a neutron star is measured in a measure called a solar mass, and so one solar mass is equal to the same mass as our sun, which is approximately 2 octillion tons. So that's a 2 with 27 zeros after it.
That's quite a big number then.
Absolutely, yeah. So neutron stars are measured in solar masses, and a typical neutron star weighs around 3 solar masses. So that's 3 times the weight of our sun. And that's densely packed into an area that's around about 10 kilometers in radius. So if you think about, think about those numbers, that is just mind blowing. So if you took a teaspoon of the stuff, it would weigh around 6 million tons, which is crazy.
That is amazing. There's a lot of information in there. And you lost me at teaspoon, I think.
Oh, brilliant. All right. Well, let's move on from neutron stars.
That is fascinating. That's an unbelievable figure. That's shocking, really, isn't it? That all that is going on above our heads and we just don't know about it. Well, we do obviously know about it. We just don't see it and it just happens.
Exactly.
Wow.
It's just mind-boggling concepts, really.
It is. Yeah. Okay. And talking about mind-boggling concepts.
Mind-boggling concepts. We've been having some discussions around how to solve some problems around getting particular components within our system talking to one another, which got us talking about service buses. So we thought we'd have a bit more of a discussion around service buses. So shall we all get aboard the .NET Ramble service bus and take a ride?
I like what you did there. Very good.
Brilliant. Did you see that? See what I did?
Smooth. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So, yeah, I say they're becoming more popular. They've always been popular. It's always been something that's been out there. It depends on sort of the systems you use, because they're sort of like service bus, enterprise service bus, service orientated architecture. It's all these buzzwords and all this stuff that's related to it, which you sort of come across more with enterprise systems in bigger companies. It's not the sort of thing smaller companies get into, because it gets complicated. It adds a lot more to it. So yeah, it's the sort of thing that you add in when you've got you need a layer of abstraction to put in a good design between systems, so it handles heavy lifting between systems, and it's sort of a backbone of your architecture when you need things to communicate and be loosely coupled. So it basically replaces all of your direct communication between systems, takes that away, hopefully in an easy way that's sort of interfaced up, so that you can just plug it in, ideally.
Brilliant. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it's essentially a service bus is a communication mechanism to allow different parts to talk to each other in a system.
It is. Absolutely. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent. So what are some examples of some service buses that that we might come across?
So there's a few out there. Common ones I've come across, N Service Bus is probably the biggest one. Very popular. It's one of the paid for solutions.
Yeah.
So it's got support with it. But it's used all over the place. I've seen it used in many companies. Very easy to plug it into sort of a .NET architecture. But then, you know, obviously there's stuff from the Microsoft world. When Azure came out, obviously they've got their own service bus. BizTalk was one that added an enterprise service bus added to it as a sort of, I think that was more of a toolkit that got added as an extra thing.
Yeah.
And then one I've used in the past is an open source one called Rebus, which I found really, really good, actually. It's just sort of a NuGet package that you drop into your apps, whatever they are, whether they're console apps, services, web apps, APIs, whatever. And it basically does what you said. It gives you the communication mechanism to send messages between systems, and it takes care of whatever the underlying architecture is that you want. So however you want to store it, it can generally use other ways of storing things like queues or disk or databases or whatever you've got.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, so a service bus is something that sits over the top of a queue. It's not necessarily the same thing as a queue.
That's right. Yeah. We'll sort of touch on that in a bit, I think. We'll sort of discuss the differences between them. But yeah, you're absolutely right. It's an extraction on top of. Yeah, it sits on top of it. That's right.
Okay, brilliant. All right. So before we get into that then, what are some examples of when you might need to use one, or what sorts of problems might you solve with a service bus?
So, yeah, I think I mentioned it. Sort of when you've sort of got different systems that want to talk to each other, so you want to loosely couple things. You don't want things pointing at each other, because it's been the bane of my life, to be honest. When you've got stuff that is directly connected to one another, you get loads of problems where, you know, if one disappears, you're going to get errors between it. And if it's not there, you can't talk to it. So, you're tightly coupled, more of a tightly coupled system in that respect. But it does add complexity. You've got more things to manage. Obviously, you've got the infrastructure between them. You've got to have this technology somewhere, the queue or the database, or something like that. It's another cog in the wheel sort of thing. But for things like handing off long-running processes or intensive processes, or where you've got lots of things coming in that you want to deal with on a slower basis, something like that. And the rule of thumb is that, but generally, if it can solve more problems than it causes, it's probably a good idea to use one. And you'll generally know that you've got a problem that could be solved with something like a service bus.
It's an interesting point, that one, isn't it? Because quite often with, lots of these tools that we use in software development or frameworks or architectures, it's always a balancing act, isn't it? Yeah. Quite often you'll introduce a particular pattern that'll solve one problem, but that inevitably comes with other problems that you need to solve. So it's always a balancing act, isn't it? And it always comes back to really understanding the problem that you're trying to solve and really looking at trying to solve that in the best way possible. So you're not introducing a whole load of other problems that then makes life life too difficult going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. You do. You find these things is that you'll use something like this to solve the problem, but it will introduce other problems. You've got other things you've got to manage, other stuff you've got to learn. So that's right. And it could, you know, in some cases, it will give you more problems than it solves. So it's just not worth it. There'll be another way of solving whatever your problem is. So, yeah, it's another tool. It's another way of doing it. It's just got to be the right way.
Yeah, interesting. And I guess we can get into some of those problems and looking at some more specific sort of applications of a service bus as we get further in. But so coming back to that question around, okay, well, it sounds like a service bus is a communication mechanism to allow different parts of your system to talk to one another. The thing that immediately springs to mind when we talk about, you know, communicating is either a HTTP call or some sort of other asynchronous mechanism like a queue. Mm-hmm. So how does a service bus differ from a queue? So you talked about the fact that we've got, you know, we might have a queuing mechanism underneath as the transport mechanism, but what have we got sitting on top of the queue that, and what value does that give?
Yeah, good questions. So it's really difficult now actually because the lines have become more blurred between these things. Because I've used queues in a very similar way to a service bus. So things like RabbitMQ, which is a queuing service, gives you some of the functionality of a service bus. You know, there's common patterns that a service bus gives you with things like what are called pub sub patterns. You've got publishers, you've got subscribers, and recently queuing systems, not just Rabbit, some of the other ones, they've introduced pub sub patterns within themselves, so you know you can actually use them on their own. And what I've seen with the things like a service bus, it basically extracts that away, so you don't need to worry about that. What you can focus on is getting a message from one place to another, or getting a message to many places, and you don't need to actually worry about does my message get through, how am I going to store it, what about retries, all of this sort of thing. It's taken that away because it's going to deal with it for you behind the scenes. So it's trying to make something that can be complex a lot less complex and a lot simpler, so you can drop it in and you just configure it up and off you go, start using it. So yeah, generally to make it simpler.
Interesting point that around the ability to implement a publish subscribe pattern, because coming back to that idea of decoupling an application, a pub sub pattern really helps with that, doesn't it? If you sort of sit two approaches side by side, you know, one side where you've got a pub sub set up, and then alongside that where you've got one system sending a message directly to another system, maybe via a queue, obviously the pub sub way of doing it is going to reduce the coupling because the thing firing off the communication doesn't know about who else is subscribing to, you know, to those messages. So that's a great way of decoupling a system, isn't it? So that's one of the many benefits, I guess, that a service bus will offer. But as you say, things like RabbitMQ are starting to sort of blur that line and offer some of that functionality as part of their, you know, their queuing product, essentially. Yeah. So it's an interesting point there.
Yeah. The only thing I'd say with a queue, one thing I think it still offers over a service bus, last time I checked, is that it's more what's called first in, first out. So what generally goes onto the queue comes off in the same order. So it's a guaranteed, where I think more with the service bus, it can differ. So that's something you might then want to look at a queue in place of a service bus. If delivery of messages in order is very important for you, then a queue would be a preference.
Interesting. Yeah, brilliant. Yeah. Excellent. But obviously you then need to weigh up that, the value of having that queue with potentially not having those other abstractions in there. So again, coming back
Same
to
again.
That point around, it's all a bit of a balancing act.
That's
around
right.
what are the problems that you need to solve. Yeah,
absolutely.
Interesting. So let's have a look at how using a service bus to communicate between components might differ from using something as simple as a HTTP call. What are the things that are going to start to differ? What sorts of things do you need to think about if we're thinking about using a service bus as opposed to a straightforward HTTP call? Is there differences in the way that you need to structure the system, you know, how messages are potentially going to be processed and how data is going to be saved? Does that start to sort of come into the frame?
It does. Yeah, you do need to think about all of that. Obviously, it's a mindset change that, you know, generally we're used to, you know, you browse to a website, so you're making an HTTP call. If you do that in code, you're doing the same thing. You open a connection to something, you get some data from it, you process that data and you're done with it. And all of that is generally synchronous. So you've done it in a sequence, you've got the response, you deal with it, you come back. Whereas when you're using service buses, there's a lot more asynchronous stuff going on. So you're going to send off a message and generally you won't necessarily get response back because you've put it onto the service bus, it goes off and it gets dealt with. And really, in a way, you don't care if it's been dealt with because the things that deal with it might not be there at the moment. They might be busy on something else, or they might not be up. They might have crashed or something. So it'll be picked up and fixed later. So your system is very much more of a you fire it, forget about it, and it's just dealt with. And it reduces your coupling. So you don't necessarily need to know what you're pointing to. You're just going to generally, you've got a service bus, and that could have hundreds of things looking at it, waiting for messages to come on it. But you've got no idea about that. What you're going to do is you're going to deal with one thing, which is your service bus, send out a message, and whatever is waiting for it and listening will pick it up and deal with it. So you don't need to, you're not really tied directly to a single thing. Obviously, you've got the service bus, and that is still the common thing that you're looking at, but that can now go out to many, many different things. Like we said, the pub sub model, you can have many subscribers, whereas before you'd be talking possibly to a single point, and that's very different how you would do that.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? Yeah, so no longer are you targeting one HTTP endpoint. Mm. You're saying, okay, I need to send something to the bus, and that's all your code needs to know about. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's right. Yeah. So, you get additional things like durability. So, in your own code, you could write your own handler that deals with, if the HTTP endpoint is down, you've got to write something. Maybe you've got to make a note of that and try again later. And all that sort of thing you generally get as part of the service bus. So as long as you can get it on the service bus, it's going to be stored. Even if the service bus goes down, that message is still there. If the subscriber is down, the message is still there. When the subscriber comes up, it will pick it up and carry on processing it. So durability is a lot better with this sort of thing. It's taken away a chunk of your code. If you haven't got to write that code, you've obviously not got to get it right. You debug it, have bugs in it. It's dealt with for you.
Obviously subject to how you configure the service bus.
Yeah, all this is configurable. So yeah, if you decide you don't want the durability, obviously, again, like we talked about, it's a trade-off because durability gives you more issues because you could be storing things on disk, which is then you've got IO, you've got disk space, you've got all of that sort of thing. But if these are important messages, then you don't want to lose them. But if you don't need it, you don't configure it. Again, it's the nice thing about it. But it's something you take away from your application. So, you can build your application a lot quicker. And if you're building a few different applications, they don't all need to have that same feature that, that's dealt with in a single place now, it's much better. And it deals with, the durability side, it's error, retries. That'll all be dealt with. But you do then get things like eventual consistency. So like we said, if the message sits on the queue because the endpoint's not there, then what you would normally expect to go through and be dealt with isn't dealt with. So it could be something like a change of address, for instance, where you've got a system where you put customer change of address through another system that deals with it. If that system's down for some reason, that change of address won't happen. And if that system is responsible for sort of the master data for a customer, obviously that change of address doesn't happen, therefore the address is still the same, everybody's still doing things. So if you're delayed changing address, you might mistakenly send out an invoice to an old address or something. So you've got that sort of challenge to deal with.
It's an interesting point that for those users that are used to making a change and then seeing that change reflected in the user interface. Please excuse that sound in the background. We've got some work going on.
No problem.
And then used to seeing that change reflected in the user interface. That's something you need to think through, isn't it? Because if your architecture is such that your data is eventually saved down into whatever data store it's going to end up in, you need to think through how that's going to work in terms of a user interface and how you're going to reflect that back to the users, whether you save a copy of that data locally and you mark it as such that it hasn't been confirmed. There's that noise again, apologies. But there's some interesting challenges around eventual consistency versus that, immediately consistent. Yeah,
it is. And like you said, it's a mindset change. You've got to think about how these things work now, because like we're saying, if things are, you know, you fire off a message and it just disappears somewhere, you can't assume it's worked. You can't assume it's got to the other end. You've got to wait and know that it's worked. So it's a case of, like we're saying, it's eventual consistency. Eventually it will get there, but while it's not there, you've got to assume that what you still got is correct. You can't immediately tell the user it's worked or something's happened, because it may not have. So yeah, it's a different way of thinking about it, different way of presenting your data, and making sure your users are aware of that. Just, you know, you see it in a lot of places. You know, this I see it all the time with things like unsubscribing from newsletters. You know, you say I'm going to unsubscribe from a newsletter, this could take up to 28 days, which is unfathomable, to be honest. Hopefully your system won't be that bad, but you know, with things like that, it could be that, yeah, you've got stuff queued up in the background and it's just not going to be able to update that or change that, because it's got to cascade through to all of these different systems. So some of the stuff might get through, and it's a trade-off again, like we said. You're trading off that, you know, we can deal with a lot more things going on, we can handle a lot more stuff, but we can't do it all instantaneously. That's the sort of downside to it. It will get there eventually, but we've got to deal with it in a slightly different way. So things like CRUD, it's got to be thought of in a different way. So, you know, you might, like we're talking about changing address, you might be creating brand new users, and you might have a flow in the system where you create a brand new user, and that message gets sent off, and as part of that, it triggers another message that gets sent off and put on the service bus, which goes somewhere else. So you might create a new user that adds it to a system. They then get set up in another system. And, you know, we can carry on like that. You can send it to multiple places. As soon as the user's set up, of course, you can trigger that as a message to all of your other applications, and they'll bring in that new data. Then they've got that information to show to people. So, you know, that's it. And you sort of see it sometimes when you ring companies and they say, oh, hang on, the system's running very slow today, or I haven't got that information. It could be because you've recently signed up to something, your data hasn't yet been replicated around, and that's one of the reasons it might occur. It might not be, but that's a common thing with this type of thing.
Interesting, yeah. It all comes back to that trade-off, doesn't it? Apologies again for the noise in the background. But with the advantage of having durable messages being sent back and forth, with the advantage of being able to retry something if it fails, then the trade-off for that is you're communicating asynchronously, you've got eventual consistency that you then have to cater for. So it's an interesting balancing act, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
Interesting. So we talked a bit about PubSub architecture.
Yeah.
Just for those who aren't familiar with PubSub, what is PubSub sort of architecture, and why, you know, why might we prefer that?
Yeah, so it's normally the common pattern with service buses is PubSub, and you know when you start looking into this thing, you'll hear it all the time. You'll hear it with service based architecture, you'll hear it with queuing and stuff like that. It's a common thing. So you generally have a publisher, so it's short for publisher subscriber. So you'll have generally a single publisher, and that publisher will publish the information that other people want. So it could be, like I said, the case of somebody wants their address changed. So you'll publish an address change, and then you'll have one or more subscribers to that information. So it could be that you've got an invoice service that needs that information, but you also might have a dispatch service that needs that information. So you might have two that listen to it, and they both get that piece of information. It differs. Obviously, every system's different, but generally, you have a single producer and many subscribers, and it can also be called producer consumer. So you have something that produces something, and then many consumers of it. And the thing, I was sort of shown it as a when I first started learning it. Things like magazine subscriptions. You generally have a publisher of a magazine, and that goes out to many subscribers. It fits in perfectly, really. It's, you know, you have one magazine that's sent out to many people. And obviously, if nobody is subscribed to that magazine, they won't send it out. And that's generally how it works as well, that if you don't have anybody subscribing to it, it generally doesn't. It just disappears. You don't need to worry about that. But obviously, talking about scalability, if you've got a PubSub model, then you could actually start introducing many consumers. So if you've got messages coming through at a fairly standard rate, but then all of a sudden, I don't know, you've got Christmas or Black Friday or one of the other events that occur, suddenly you've got 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times more messages coming through. So you can actually increase the number of consumers and they can then process that extra load for you temporarily, and then you can dial it back when that disappears. So it could be that you spin up lots of new machines in the cloud or lots of new services in the cloud and deal with all that coming through. But the flip side is true as well. You could also produce more producers. You can have more people producing data, and then you might be able to consume it a lot quicker than you can produce it, or vice versa. It depends really on the design. But yeah, very, very good for scalability. Gives you the ability to sort of tweak it to your changing requirements.
And scale yeah. horizontally up and down as That's needed. Right. Yeah. Interesting. I mean, that obviously leads nicely into this idea of event sourcing. So if we are publishing events off to our subscribers, an event sourced model works quite well with that, doesn't it? Because, you know, that pub sub architecture, you know, works really well for the point at which we need to let everyone know that an event's happened.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you do, generally, they are generally events that go on this sort of thing. So, I mean, you will hear a commands being sent as well, but generally, most things can be referred to as events. So you will send an event like new customer event, or a change of address event, or an order event, or a dispatch event. So, you know, there can be any point in the timeline. You know, obviously, generally, you get orders coming in, and then you get orders being dispatched, and then you might get invoices being sent or something like that. And all this can happen in that sort of thing. So yeah, it is an event based system. Things happen, they get sent to the bus, and then they're dealt with by things. So that, you know, there's another common thing called event sourcing, and that's slightly different. You could use this to record events. I've known places where they've done it before. So, you know, you'd still have something on the end that listens to all the events. I mean, it can be quite nice as a auditing logging mechanism as well. So as events go through, they're dealt with, but they're also taken off into another system where they're recorded and logged. So you can see that they happened, and then you can obviously go back through them later, which is very similar sort of to an event store. You can replay all of those and see the whole process of, you know, an example, sort of an order being produced, then an item being picked and then dispatched, and then an invoice being produced for it. You can see that happening, and it could be that you trace it through and you see that something didn't quite work. You know, the invoice production may not have got picked up and dealt with, so you can see it. But generally, if you've got event streams, then there's other things that can deal with that, things like Kafka or Event Store, and they're platforms in their own right that can deal with it. So they would take that need to have a service bus away, because they're dealing with it directly for you. But there are ways you can roll your own and have it work for you if you need it like that.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess in a microservice sort of architecture, you might have Kafka in one service, and then, you know, use a service bus for some other services to communicate with one another.
Yeah, it's a nice thing about it. You can mix and match these things. So, you know, because you've got, you're not tightly coupled. So these things can be anywhere, really. They can be anywhere. They can be any technology, really. As long as they can talk to each other over your service bus, you can have various tech platforms involved in it. So yeah, absolutely.
Brilliant. So again, leading on into something like CQRS, you know, command query responsibility segregation, again, I guess a service bus could be used to send commands between, you know, from one system into another, and then to respond with, you know, with read data. So I assume a service bus could be used in that context as well.
Absolutely, yeah, it could be. Obviously, it's not necessary for it, but yes, it could be. It can be the underlying transport. So, yeah, obviously, CQRS, it's up to you the way you implement it. If you need to send messages to various places, then yeah, this would be the ideal sort of thing to use for it. Absolutely.
Yeah. Interesting, yeah. So I guess with all of these approaches, the particular architectural approach you use will govern how you design your system and your services. Does the usage of a service bus sort of prescribe any particular architectural pattern, or does the use of the service bus sort of require you to design things in certain ways?
Yeah, it does. Like we said earlier, we sort of touched on it a little bit. It's a mindset change, because you're not dealing with things instantly. We're talking about this eventual consistency. Things happen at some point. So it makes designing your UI a lot different, because you can't reflect changes immediately. Things will have to go away, and things will get updated behind the scenes. So yeah, it probably depends. In some cases, yes, you've got issues for your UI, you can't show something immediately, but other cases you just don't care anyway. It's a case that you're going to fire and forget about it, because it's not up to you to deal with it. what you're concerned about is that you've dealt with it and it's gone away. So for instance, the order, you know, somebody's put an order together on your website and then you've pushed that order onto the service bus. That's fine. As far as you're concerned, the order has been placed. It's not going to be, it's not going to fail to get there. It will get there eventually. So you can show them that your order has been placed. You may not be able to give them an order ID immediately because you just haven't got it back yet. It's that sort of thing you can't do. And you've got to be careful of things like, you know, if an order does get placed, if for some reason it goes on there twice or something happens to it, you've got to deal with duplicates. Because obviously normally in the system you place an order and if it didn't work straight away, you might have a retry process locally for it. And if it fails again, you might tell people and say, you know, I can't place your order at this time. Please try again later. But if it goes on the queue and it's sent through a service bus, then it's generally going to get dealt with and be there. So if there's a duplicate come through, you need to have something in the system to deal with that. So it's another thing you might have to design slightly differently. Well, I think you're still on mute. Can't quite hear you.
Sorry about that. I was going to say, the idea of item potency comes into the design there, doesn't it?
That's the word. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So if something gets processed more than once, then it's not going to, you know, cause detrimental effects.
Yeah, things like, you don't want to take payment from people twice. That's always a nasty one.
Yeah, exactly. That is a bit nasty. It's interesting talking about all these data flowing back and forth. That actually leads quite nicely into our open source project of the week, which is ML.net. ML.net's obviously all about machine learning, but thinking about data flying back and forth with, you know, potentially log data and events and, you know, even security data. That leads quite nicely into building a machine learning model and potentially uncovering learnings that you weren't aware of in that data. So ML.net is a brilliant .NET open source project. It's a .NET Foundation project. So it's a slightly different open source project of the week. Usually we do a community-driven sort of project, but I thought it was certainly worth a mention this week. And it's worthy of a show in its own right, ML.NET. But it's basically a .NET abstraction that sits on top of being able to create an machine learning model and then being able to use that model to then potentially make predictions in the future. So you don't need to understand the underlying machine learning algorithms in order to be able to use ML.NET. The abstractions have been written in such a way that you can train a model, point it at some data, and then use that model, instantiate that model, and use it to then make predictions in the future. So it's a brilliant project and one that I really think we should do a dedicated show on in the future.
Yeah, I agree. That sounds great. That sounds like, something we could talk about for quite a while. So I think, it's worth putting something together for that. And, you know, it does sound like an interesting match with this, really, because if we're talking about putting events out there, obviously they can all be collected up and reviewed and processed by something like ML.net. And like you say, give you different insights into it, maybe, or look for different patterns in it, or, you know, dig out stuff. Because, you know, on systems I've worked on before, you've got tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of messages flying through the system in seconds. So there's absolutely no way a human being could keep track of it all. But yeah, if you could tie that into ML.net, that'd be really, really nice. So yeah, I think, like you say, maybe it's worth having a think about how we could tie that all together and come up with something to talk about it, use it in a little project. It'd be great. Nice.
Absolutely. We could use it in a little project. And while we're writing that project, we could use our utility of the week, which this week is Windows Terminal.
These segues are getting much better. Oh, we're getting good at this.
Aren't they? We are getting good. See, that was seamless.
Seamless. Nobody knows. I'll edit this all out, don't worry.
So Windows Terminal has been around for a while, but it's... It's a rework of the old command prompt, obviously, into a utility that allows as many bashes and command prompts as you like, all in one place. It's been around for a while. It's currently on version 1.11 is the current release version at the time that we're recording this. I think preview 1.12 is out. But it's been around for a couple of years, but it's in a really good place at the moment. They've got it to a point where all of the configuration is graphical user interface based rather than being configured via a config file. So in the early days of Windows Terminal, you had to do it through a JSON file. There's now a GUI, which is really good. It's brilliant. I use Windows Terminal all day, every day. Mm-hmm. So it's tab-based and allows you basically to set up as many bashes as you like. It gives you rich text. You can configure all of those tabs with themes and styles. All of the graphical sort of display is GPU accelerated, so it's got the potential to be really, really lovely to look at as well, depending on how you configure it. I use mine all day long with my Git Bash, PowerShell. You can set up a standard command prompt in there as well, and I even use it for WSL for Windows subsystem for Linux. I just have it all working through Windows Terminal. So it's brilliant.
Yeah.
I thought that was worthy of our utility of the week this week.
I think it's more than worthy of that. Yeah, I'm a convert to it as well. I remember you told me about it a long, long time ago, and at the time I was using a different console user. I can't remember the name of it now, but it was a different version. And I think it was back when Windows Terminal was still quite young. And it didn't have all the bells and whistles of the one that I was using. But yeah, I've switched to this. I say recently, I probably switched to it a couple of years ago now. So it's it's great. Yeah, like you say, I live in it. It's there all the time, open. I've got it open now. I've only got two tabs, which makes change. But yeah, generally I leave it running in my dev folder, and I've got another tab for other things I'm doing. So yeah, it's brilliant thing to use. Not a lot that it's missing now. Very nice that you can configure it using a GUI.
Yeah, brilliant.
So yeah, it's much easier through that now. But yeah, no, it's great. Well worth it. So go and download it. You can get it from. You can download the XE, or do you have to build it, or how do you get it?
The best place to install it is actually via the Windows Store. If you install it through that, it will keep updated, which is quite nice. Yeah. You can install it manually. You can read all about it and actually look at the source, which is like most things up on GitHub. So it's github.com/Microsoft/terminal. There's a whole README about it, and there's instructions about how to install it manually if you want to do that. Mm-hmm. You do need to have a minimum Windows 10 build of 1903 or greater. But all the details are on the GitHub site. But the best place to install it is through the Microsoft store. And it keeps updated.
Yeah, nice. Okay, nice and easy. Great.
Yeah,
okay.
Brilliant. Well, let's leave it there. That was a wonderful ride on the bus.
Hope you enjoyed your ride on the bus today.
Thoroughly enjoyed that. Learned a lot, and hopefully we can be putting service buses to good use in the future.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, it's been really good to chat with you about that. And been a bit different doing it on a Monday. So
on a Monday and with a bit of background noise as well. So,
absolutely.
Mixed it up a bit.
No, that's great. No, it's nice, all good. Sir. All good. So thanks for that. I'll catch up with you soon.
Yeah, talk to you soon. Cheers, Andy.
Cheers, Ryan. Bye.
Bye.